Welcome, welcome, welcome. Episode 70 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. My name is Scroobius Pip. You can find me at Scroobius Pip Show on Twitter and Instagram and all over the place, or facebook.com/Scroobius Pip. And I am joined today by the one and only Mr. Richard Herring, a legend of stand-up, of podcasting, of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, of sketch comedy. And I'm going to keep this intro brief because we rambled on. It was beautiful. We recorded it before I do his Richard Herring live at the Leicester Square Theatre podcast. And we had a good old chat. We really went into it. It was nice. I listened to his podcast and I love it, but he's the interviewer. So it was nice to really get into him and get a bit more of his thoughts and stories and views and opinions. So I should mention Speech of Element Records. That's my record label. Go to speechofelementrecords.com. You can buy jumpers. You can't buy hoodies. You can buy your own hoodie and wear a jumper underneath it. You can buy t-shirts, CDs, my DVD and my book, Great Christmas Presents, are right there. I've got a 2-disc DVD of my Edinburgh Fringe show, and I've got my graphic novel of poems. So check them out at speechofelementrecords.com. I'm going to go on now and let you listen to episode 70 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Richard Herring. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. And we're rolling.
Cool.
There we go. I'm joined by comedy and podcasting a legend, Mr. Richard Herring. How are you?
I'm not too bad. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. This is exciting because we're doing a bit of a crossover.
Yeah.
So I'm actually recording this before I'm on your podcast,
yep,
but I think it's going out after.
I don't know. You won't go out for quite a while, the one
we're
doing.
Oh, that's good then. That's fine.
I'm recording 2 a week and putting out 1 a week, so it's probably in the new year.
That's perfect then. Then I get to be the exclusive and get out first. So, you know, it's good. In that case, it's in the correct order.
Okay,
and we will be discussing things now,
yeah,
and then we'll see how it all goes at the weekend.
Then we'll just talk about the same things again at the
weekend. Yeah, we'll just go
enough
over
time
them.
Will have passed.
I did your podcast once before at the Edinburgh Fringe.
That's right, yeah.
I've always felt I wasn't very good on it, so I'm glad to get a second chance.
I think you were good on it.
I felt I was a bit bogged down by the Fringe and a bit not quite there or sharp. I feel I'm excited to have a second.
Oh, good.
Second
well,
run
I can't
at
remember
it,
to be honest, because
exactly
those Edinburgh ones
felt very unmemorable.
I did two interviews a day. I think for some of them it was one interview a day, but it was every day and doing my own show.
Yeah.
So I often can't remember. I mean, I was sure I'd interviewed Phil Jupiter on one of those.
Yeah.
And like to the point that I could remember it, but I hadn't done. Just talked to him.
I was going
to
say that's because at some point in one evening, Phil will have talked very loudly at you.
Yeah.
Intently, and it would have felt like it was a performance and a recorded thing,
but often, even with the Leicester Square ones, because I've done 90, it'll be 100 by the end of the series,
that was
100 interviews, and sometimes I think, oh, I should get such and such on, and then I look through and go, oh no, he's been on
already. We've had that, yeah. So is it planned as 100 and then you're ending it there? Is that
it's going to carry on forever. It's just it just so happens it's 100 at the end of the series. It was going to be 101, but then I interviewed myself as a because I kickstarted the video because we'd filmed so I did a Kickstarter, and one of the Kickstarter prizes was for me to interview myself.
Yeah.
Which I'd planned to do in my attic, where my office is, as a, you know, because I thought it would be quite embarrassing.
Yeah.
But then we hadn't got another guest, and I thought, actually, maybe it would be better to do it in front of an audience, and maybe people will come and see it. But they didn't sell that many extra tickets. I'm not that much of a draw in my own thing. So I did it in front of an audience, which was quite embarrassing.
But yeah, just talking to yourself for ages.
Yeah, for an hour. So it was. But it passed very quickly. With all of them, I'm concentrating so hard, listening and talking, that I often can't remember. When it comes to writing up what happened in it, I can't remember anything.
I've recently, as we're recording this today, I've just put out the live podcast I did at the Leicester Square Theatre.
Right.
Just completely copying you here. I thought, I'll do it there. That's where Richard does it. That's fine.
Good place to do it.
And I was doing a post, and I was going to, because the first half I was interviewing a fan, and the second half I had just people come up and ask questions.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do an answer question such as, and my mind was so fried from that event. I was like, I had to write, I honestly don't know what questions I answered, but I remember it was a good night, and everyone seemed to enjoy themselves.
Well, that's
so
it. I can remember that. I can remember the ones where I feel don't go so well from my own point of view usually. But yeah, it's very hard. Even the day next day, very hard to remember anything. Or, you know, think, oh, there were some big laughs there, and then they can't remember what they were.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's I think that's it, because it is really difficult to talk to people, especially when you do two. And actually, this series, I'm a bit constricted by the fact they've booked me in at 4 o'clock, and there's usually shows on at 7:15, so I've got to get out.
Yeah, you're having to try and be engaging, but also keep an eye on the time, yeah, keep an eye on getting through.
Which is annoying me, because I really like the ones that can go, you know, if you're having a nice time with someone, and even if you're not, even if it's kind of dipping a bit, to push it on and go on for another half an hour can often be the... Yeah. The way you get the gold to come out of it,
yeah, completely.
So so slightly annoying, but they've been largely. We did, we've had a good few. So
I definitely think, particularly with an audience, it can take a minute to get them extra relaxed or out of performance mode. Which performance mode is good because you still want it to be entertaining. But I think some of the ones of your podcasts I've enjoyed the most and that have got the most acclaim have been when it really feels like it's two people having quite a private conversation in at points and that kind of.
And I think once you get into it, once it's longer, that it's much easier for the guest to forget that it's real going out and that actually other people are listening. So they do tend to open up. At about the 75-minute mark, which is when I have to stop, really, basically, on these ones, I find that it kind of, even if they've been really funny, there's a little lull and it gets a bit gentler and then and then something interesting or boring, but then that's still interesting happens.
Yeah, completely. you've obviously... embrace in this section of your career, in the section of your career that is available, I feel you've really embraced and made the most of social media and the internet. So things like the Kickstarter, a project to do a filmed episode, is that something that you're just into, or was it an active business decision of if I'm not getting huge budgets for advertising, whether I need to have this instant content?
I don't think I've really ever planned anything. It sort of worked out quite well. I mean, I would be a very clever businessman if I'd worked out this would work. But it sort of does work, I think, because I initially got into podcasting because I'd done a show with Andrew Collins and on his six. I'm just going for half an hour and talk to him about the papers. Yeah. And then that got cancelled and we'd enjoyed that. And about a year passed, and then he said to me, oh, look, I did I think it was the Word podcast or something like that. And he said, it's really easy. You just have a computer, and we just need to find someone who can load it up for us.
Yeah.
So when we realised how easy it was to do it, we thought, well, let's do it for fun, because we'd enjoyed it. And then I think maybe at the back of our minds we thought, maybe if we're really funny on it, Six Music might hear it and say, oh, come back and do another show.
Or the Heron and Collins one, it was really at that time when Six Music, it felt like they were... at the forefront of podcasting, as weird as it was, because they'd done the Adam and Joe ones and they'd had so many good ones. So that was a perfect kind of a birth into it, I guess.
I suppose, but then we were so rude. It became very quickly very rude, like ridiculously rude. So I don't know if that was, that was obviously not a deliberate decision, because I think that would have put people off. We did eventually get our own Six Music show. Anyway, we did replace Adam and Joe for a year or so. So it sort of, that did work after about 3 years. But it was more about just having fun. And then I realised, I realised I had lots of ideas and I was finding it difficult to get them on TV and radio.
Yeah.
I was still getting some of them on TV and radio, but it was a slog and people were changing it. And then that Saxgate thing happened and people were being very cautious when you're on the radio or TV about how rude you were allowed to be. And so I realised the freedom we had making it ourselves. I realised I could do anything I wanted and get it out there pretty quickly, as long as I, if it wasn't difficult to edit. Which that's why we don't edit. I never edited because it's just cheaper.
I'm exactly the same. It's been seen as such a stylistic choice, and these bold, unedited conversations. It's like, it's just easier that way.
Then it's the time. Then it's the time it takes, more or less, plus an hour or so either end.
Yeah.
So you can get much more done. I think it's more interesting to include everything anyway. So the hits and the flops are there together for you to judge whether the thing's good
completely.
Or not. And so, I really liked it in itself, and I've kind of realised it's an end in itself, but it's had these repercussions. And I was touring. I've been sort of touring for about 7 years on my own when I started doing podcasts, and I've been sort of ticking along, selling 50 to 100 tickets most places I went, scraping a living, it was worthwhile doing, but only just. And then when I started doing the podcasts, of course, if you're going into people's homes every week and they're choosing and they like it, when you say, oh, and I'm in Bristol this week, then if they're in Bristol, they're probably going to go, oh, well, A, I owe him a bit because he's given me all this ass of entertainment, B, I like him, so let's go and see him. So it was a way to advertise what you were doing.
Completely, and that's exactly what I was going to say. The fact that podcasts are in general free, is it really does engage people in that way, because it's something that I enjoy doing, and I'd imagine that you enjoy doing, yeah. but it gives you that, as you said, that access into their living rooms, that yeah. regular free thing. So when you've got something, you have to say, could you pay for this?
Yeah.
They're kind of like, well, yeah, yeah, that's fair, that's fine.
Yeah, so I've done 8 years of podcasts, and I really wanted to keep, nearly everything I've done has been completely free. Occasionally I would have like a bit of extra content for a tiny bit more money or whatever, yeah. or occasionally we ask people to pay for the videos of the rehearsal to begin with. But yeah, I think by making it free, and then you'd have to be kind of idiot to every now and again not go, oh, well, I'll give them £1.
Yeah,
for this or so. So then we started doing badges for £1, just as a joke, really, because that was an old Collins and Herring thing.
Yeah,
and we should have made it more than £1, but you know, quite a lot of people give us £1 for a badge. Yeah, yeah. And then I had the idea of having a monthly pound badge, which gives you access to a few more little bits and pieces.
Oh, wicked!
So those ways bring in a little bit of income, and then obviously the Kickstarter is a more recent thing.
Yeah.
So how did that go,
and what kind of prizes? Did you give for Kickstarter?
Last one was this DVD of me interviewing myself, but also the first one I did, because I was going on about having my tiny hands that are like Hermione's, they're the same hands size as Hermione's hands. So I drew around my hands 600 times.
Brilliant.
And sent 600 people one of those, badges, mugs and things like that, which you know, because they're actually a limited run, we'll do 200 mugs and that's it. Oh, and then I'd do handmade... See, I'm a very bad artist, but I draw awful T-shirts that are kind of... still sort of engaging in their childlike naivety.
Yeah.
So that's a complete one-off T-shirt that, you know, I think this time we're doing a print of one of them so people can get, there'll be more than one copy of it. Most of them are a completely individual work of art.
I remember
not very good work of art.
Touring with a guy called B. Dolan, and he'd sold out of his little mixtape.
Right.
And we were midway through the tour, and he's over from America, so he can't get more. So he bought a load of CDRs, hand-drew all the cases, ended up charging more for them, because he's like, well, these are exclusive hand-drawn. Yeah. I was like, mate, it's because you've run out and you're just trying to make more money. And they sold far better than everything else, because it's like, well, yeah, I guess so.
With all these things, I sort of feel like... It's not that I'd like to give people back more than they've paid in a way.
Yeah.
And I feel that regardless, I think those T-shirts at some point, you know, unless I become, you know, I'm less famous, if I become more famous, they'll be worth a lot of money. But I think even so, because they're one off to a fan, I've got enough fans that someone could sell that on for more than they paid. So I kind of like that idea that I'm giving back something that's worthwhile.
Yeah.
Even if it is a drawing around my own hand, which, you know, again, I've put a few of these things on eBay and they'll sell for 20, 30, 50, £100. So it's that's another way of bringing in money. So obviously, I'd like to get more adventurous with it. I feel like I wish it had come, the internet had come sort of 10 or 15 years earlier in a way. But
yeah, damn right.
For me, just because I don't know how long I can carry on at this level of hard work.
Yeah.
But you know, I'd love to get to the point where I'm making TV quality sketch shows, sitcoms, you know, films even from. So I think if the more I could encourage people to, and that's the annoying thing, you know, if everyone who listened to my podcast gave me £1 a year, I could make a sitcom. If everyone gave me £10 a year, I could make movies.
Yeah, that's
so
a great
you know,
point,
so
isn't it?
And when you think about what you're getting in return for that, and so I it's a matter of the audience trusting me. And at the moment, I don't take any money myself out of any of this money. Yeah. So all the money goes back into
producing
making
more
stuff.
Yeah.
So I'll make some money on the door of the Leicester Square Theatre if we sell enough tickets to make that worthwhile. Yeah. And, you know, and again, I think it pays off. I think my next tour feels like I've only done a few gigs, but it feels like I'm selling more tickets. So again, as long as people keep coming to see me live, then that's enough in itself. So people can choose. There's a lot of different ways people can choose to pay me back. Or just but I want to keep it free for the people who genuinely can't. And then similarly, like with my live gigs, if someone emails me and says, I can't afford to come and see it, I'll say, look, I'll put you on the door, which I can do.
I mean, you're going to get all the emails.
They can
do it,
but honestly, if you honestly can't afford to come and see it, then email me. And if there's tickets, and I get 6 tickets for every gig for free that I can give
out.
That's great. If they're still there, or if there are any tickets left and I haven't sold it, I'd rather people came. If you want a lie and you can afford it and you want free tickets, then that's up to you. So
on your head be it.
But I just think it's up to you. But then that's up to you. If you're listening to it and you're listening to all this stuff and go, I don't want to give you anything and I'm not going to tell anyone else about it, that's fine.
That's your choice.
That's fine, that's your choice. But, I think most people, after 8 years, I felt that I could say, hey, you know, if you want, and with the video, it was really very much like, if you want more of this stuff, if you want it videoed, we can video it if you pay for it.
Yeah.
But I can't afford to pay £50,000 a series out of my own money.
Yeah, completely.
Like, I'm doing okay, but I can't afford to do that.
Yeah, that's not going
to
happen.
So, but if, you know, if we all chip in a tiny amount, then we can do it. And yeah, if you don't want it, that. If you don't want it, we won't do it. But we'll carry on doing the audio for free. So that's lovely that people want to get involved. I've sort of done a joke one. I do a podcast where I play myself at snooker in my basement and commentate
yep.
on it.
Yeah.
And I did a joke Kickstarter that I kind of hoped might take off and not be a joke, where I was trying to raise £1 million to build a specific venue for that to be performed.
Amazing.
And film it, and cameras and cameramen. Which is up to, it's not over yet, and it could still happen.
Yeah.
It's up to £50,000.
That's still quite insane.
But a lot of people have done that knowing that their money is
safe. Never make it, and it'll never complete, so, I guess.
And
so.
You could just withdraw your money. I sort of see that the snooker thing as much an artwork as a comedy thing, or as a sports, really. It's not comedy, and it's art, and so that's part. I feel the Kickstarter's part of that artistic statement, and it is meant to make you think about the value of money, because it's quite fun to be able to go, I'm going to put £5,000 into this, knowing my £5,000 is definitely safe. But what's funny is a couple of people who put £5,000 in have then had their credit cards declined and had the fraud squad onto them, even though the money hasn't been taken out of their accounts.
But it's because it gets sent aside.
And so there's someone genuinely, it's really inconvenienced a couple of people, and someone had a call from the fraud squad and presumably then had to go, well, it's all right, I'm just trying to fund this guy who wants £1 million to play himself at snooker, he'll never do it.
He's not really going to do it. It's not a real investment.
So it's sort of playing with the value of money, and I think when you do something like that, it sort of makes money seem ridiculous. But then also, you know, I might make £1 million, and then I'll have £1 million.
Yeah,
which would be amazing.
You can knock a venue up for a few grand. You spoke there of how it'd be nice if the internet had come along earlier, and the kind of the years in between of being on a high and then struggling at points. It makes it all the more impressive that you've consistently produced a new show each year, and it's something that always took me ages to realise with comedians, because with bands and musicians you can tour and add a new song or two, keep doing the hits for years and years. But for so many comedians, it's partly Edinburgh based and partly tour based, but it's a new show each year, and you've done that. Is it 12 years in a row?
Well, I've done 12 different shows in 12 years, though two of them I did twice. So I did Christ on a Bike in 2001 and Talking Cock in 2002, then I had a year off, and then since 2004 I've done a new show every year, one of them's been Talking Cock, Christ on a Bike. So I've basically written 10 shows in the last 12 years, and I've done, but I've toured twice. You know, when I did them, I toured them again. Yeah. So I've toured every year since 2001 and it's just, but again, it's the hard. I think it's understanding that it's hard work. It's very competitive. My business, and it's increasingly getting more competitive. And like a lot of people are complaining about this, that it's very difficult to tour, because it's like you have to either be on TV or known already or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's very hard to get from that stage where you're doing clubs to touring. But when we were on TV and when I did stuff with Stuart, we didn't really, when we toured, hardly anyone came to see us. I think they were maybe too young or just, you know, we weren't as popular as. At the time, as people seem to remember us being, or maybe the people who liked us enough and have stayed with us, we didn't break through that ceiling. So we toured largely to quite big theatres with hardly anyone in them. So when I came, it was like a year after the TV had finished, I was started touring on my own. And I was really struggling to get people to come and see me. And because it's difficult, because someone say 10, 15 quid even, for their evening, it's their evening, it's their time. The older you get, the more you understand. Yeah. You know, when you've got family, this is an evening out is a big deal.
Yeah, completely. Not only the money side of it, need to have a clear evening.
So you really got to work hard to get those people in. Mm. So I've done that by just relentlessly touring and hoping that the people who liked it, the 30 people who liked it, or 20 to 30 people would have liked it, and those 20 people will bring another person, so next year it'll be 40 people. Yeah. And it does, it has worked very slowly, and the podcast did make a noticeable difference where my audience sort of doubled pretty much into the next tour, but that's still small numbers.
Have you seen the kind of the touring roots mirroring the Fringe? Because I felt that the first time I got to go to the Fringe, it felt like you had such a loyal following up there. Yeah. It felt like everyone knew, or there was a good portion that knew that if you're at the Fringe, which you are every year, except for this last one.
Yeah,
it was last year. So, but in general, they know that they will, on their list is, right, we're going to the Fringe, obviously we're going to see Richard, and then, you know, figuring everything else around it. Have you had similar on the touring schedules? Well, is it you have certain places that you know every time you go there?
Yeah, I guess. But even Edinburgh, it took me quite a long time to build up that audience. I mean, I was getting smallish crowds. Even Lee and Harry were getting sometimes bigger crowds when we were on the telly, but not massively so. We were known, yeah. And I was always known in Edinburgh, but it took me a while to get those solo shows really up and running. And it certainly took me, you know, it was 2005, 2006 before I even got to a point where I was not losing money up there.
Yeah.
And then I still lost a lot of money the other year, so because I was overambitious. But I was still building that audience. It was, you know, it's a weird thing. I mean, because like within the industry, people considered me to be well known and a success.
Yeah.
But I think like the public, I was a very acquired taste that most people didn't even know about. And it wasn't like they knew me and didn't like me. They just didn't know who I was. So in Edinburgh, it was a bit more like, if I go to Edinburgh, it feels a bit more like I'm famous. If I'm walking down the street, people will know who I am.
Yeah, yeah,
whereas
yeah.
mostly anywhere else, it isn't. But yeah, there are towns that I've managed to. That have embraced me more than others. Brighton always liked us. Cardiff always liked us before, even, you know, that we did well there. Bristol, I always do well in. Nottingham and places like this. Sunderland, odd places.
Yeah.
But yeah, that they seem to. But I think often it's about whether the theatre itself is geared up well and has a good mailing list.
Into it, are going to be putting it out well and getting the word out, but
it's like anything, it's building up, and if you keep on going and the stuff you're doing is good. I recently did, instead of going to Edinburgh this year, I did all of my one-man shows at the Leicester Square Theatre.
Yeah.
And going back and doing
it. How was that?
It was really interesting. I mean, it was difficult, but somehow, and I don't quite understand how I did it.
I was going to say, what was your method? I assume you've got some kind of recordings of each of them. So was it a case of watching and going over and relearning?
They're all on DVD, but I got the audios taken off all the DVDs and just listened to them like, when I was going about my business and driving places.
Cracking up.
And
tears of laughter. Well, classic.
It's sort of weird because I'd listen to them and I'd go, oh, God, this is terrible the first time. I just would be quite dismissive at the first time.
Yeah.
And then I'd do them a bit. And then actually, by the time I performed at the end of the week, I would kind of have a respect for them that I didn't expect, actually. And I'm pretty proud of all of them. They're good shows.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of those shows have passed by without anyone really, you know, without many people knowing about them.
It's one of the things that's always freaked me out, exactly that, with the Fringe. And exactly as you were saying, with the level of comedian and respect within the scene versus nationwide or worldwide recognition, is it blows my mind that the year I was at the Fringe, I went to see so many amazing shows, but they were all comedians who aren't big enough for that to be turned into a DVD.
Yeah.
So these amazing shows have just existed for that year.
Yeah.
And now they don't exist at all.
Well, that's anyway,
that's heartbreaking to me.
Well, that's
and everyone's, I guess, used to it and it's accepted. But that was killing me. Just thinking, like, wow, I want to show all my friends this, but I literally can't show my friends this because it's gone now.
Yeah.
It's over.
Well, weirdly, I suppose that was another offshoot of the internet, and was that none of my shows were big enough to be put on DVD. And, you know, a couple of them went by and weren't put on DVD, like obviously Christ on a Bike and Talking Cock. That's part of the reason I did them again, to put them on DVD. But it was getting in touch with Go Faster Stripe, was this brilliant sort of Cardiff-based, you know, guy. He's just a comedy fan, Chris Evans, not that one.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, he's just into comedy enough. He saw Stuart and said, Stuart Lee won you, and said, when's the DVD coming out? And Stuart said, oh, we're not doing a DVD of this one. And he was so upset that he said, well, look, I've got some friends who can do this and a place we can do it. Let's film it.
Amazing. And they've built a great back catalogue.
But then it's meant I've been able to do all of my shows with them. So all my shows exist. And that's just such a relief at the end of it. It's just, you sort of think it just means it doesn't go. And it is for them. They would be, I'd forgotten them. So they would be forgotten.
In a weird way, it makes it, as I said, it makes it feel, it definitely happened.
Yeah.
It definitely did happen. It's not just a weird memory.
Something. You know, it's not, they're still better live, and I still prefer the touring, and it's great to have an evening where that's what it's all about. It's the room, and it's never quite the same. And you'll never capture that on DVD, but it's just so good. So, yeah, having the DVDs was great. It meant I could do the shows again, which I wouldn't, because I have no record of most of them.
Yeah, of course.
And apart from that, and there's so much sort of improvisation, even if I did have a script.
I was going to say, particularly I'd imagine along the tour, they always develop and tighten and tweak. So even if you had some kind of initial notes, it's like, that's not what the show ended up being.
And I would never remember, I mean, I don't know how I managed to relearn them. I don't know how it got in there, but it sort of nearly got in there.
What schedule was it in? Like, was
I was doing two a week, so I was doing Friday and Saturday. So I was doing, you know,
nuts.
So Yeah, and I thought it would get easier as it got closer, but it didn't really. And then even, I mean, the only one that was easy was the one that I'd done on tour, and even that I had to think about because it was about 3 months since I'd done it.
I was going
to
say, even I'd imagine year, because you'd pushed it out with all the other ones. Yeah. So this is the one that should be the freshest. And
but even the year before, I thought, oh, We're All Going to Die would be fine because that was quite recently. And then, wow, it's hard. You'd listen and go, this is just so complicated. And, you know, because you do build it up over the tour. So it was really difficult. And, you know, I was running on adrenaline. I didn't do them perfectly. And the way I'd like to go back and take each show and give them another, especially the early ones where, you know, I wasn't as good a performer as I am now, I think. And so it was enjoyable to go back. But I found a couple of routines. You go, oh, I've forgotten this routine. Yeah. This is a great routine. So I started putting some of them back into my set, you know, which livens this up a bit, as well as writing some new stuff.
Yeah.
So it was a really good thing to do. But also I thought, you know, these are great shows. They're, you know, I'm really proud of them. But most people would never, even though they're on DVD, most people will never, ever come across them because, you know, just because the way the world works is. But as I've got older, I've kind of come to like the fact that I'm more of a little niche, the secret thing that if you discover me, you suddenly go, oh shit, this is impossible to catch up with because there's too much stuff.
Yeah, there's such a back catalogue.
There's plenty of stuff there to, you know, if you suddenly discover me, if you like me. But, you know, it's kind of nicer being. I was talking to David Mitchell on the last podcast that I've recorded, and, you know, we both recently had daughters, and you know, but there's things on the Daily Mail with him wheeling his pram around and with his wife, and you know, them just looking bleary eyed and tired, and you kind of think that's the bad side of fame, isn't it? Yeah. There's someone papping you as you're just that's a news story that David Mitchell horrible. And his wife have gone out with a baby to have a cup of coffee, and so you think, God, I'm so glad I don't have to bother with any of that. I'm glad I can walk around the streets, you know, most of the time without, and if I get someone who comes up to me, they'll go, hey, you're that guy, I love your podcast, or hey, I'm listening to your podcast now, which I love when
that's always
happens.
A weird one. I'm listening to you. Okay, I don't know how to react to that.
You know, so that's it. I realise how lucky I am, and I've been lucky enough to be in a position where I'm making enough money to carry on working and creating interesting stuff. But there's on the other hand, there's no one going, oh, Rich, you know, you better not grow a hit and moustache this year because, you know, Andrex tissue, toilet tissue won't sponsor you if you do that. Yeah. You know, I'm completely. That's what I suppose I love about the podcast is it's the autonomy, which you get as a stand-up.
Yeah.
You can absolutely do what you want.
Do exactly what you want. You know, and you're self-governed and self.
And, you know, and I think you create a community with the people who listen. And, you know, and I love it that they do get involved in whichever ways they get involved, you know, and however that is, I sort of appreciate it. But as I say, you know, I sort of think it's really nice also to not be going, oh, we're trying to make money out of this, we're trying to make this into a business. And I think but I still think it works as a business model. You know, it feels to me that we're slowly working towards getting to a point where we'll accrue enough resources to start making more
and having that
stuff.
Control and allowing artists. I've always struggled with the term underrated or people feeling that they're underrated because I think there's for me I've always felt I'm just not for everyone and that's perfectly acceptable but it feels if you start thinking underrated it feels almost disrespectful to those that do really rate you that fan base that are really passionate and really put you on such a pedestal and think you're amazing you're like well you know I've never really got the respect I deserve. It's like, well no you've got these people that adore you but it's an interesting one when it is an industry where you are surrounded by comparisons and you are looking at how everyone else is doing
but
and looking over your shoulder.
It's sort of adjusting your mindset. And, you know, I think I was more ambitious than I am now I coveted the things that I thought I wanted. But as an older man, I sort of look at the people around me who got those things I wanted and they aren't necessarily very happy about it. And you kind of think that was, you know, that you realise that the goal you were chasing wasn't necessarily, wasn't worth having. And actually what you've ended up with is much better. So, you know, and without the internet, I'd be screwed, I think. But because with the internet, if I can sell 2,000 DVDs on the internet and to 2,000 people out of the 7 billion people on the planet, then that's economically doing.
Yeah, and it's you selling them and then buying directly. Again, I think that makes a massive difference from the fan base point of view of how willing you are to invest in someone. If you're buying directly from them, you're less willing to steal a torrent or whatever else.
Well, that's it. You know, our stuff hardly ever comes up on YouTube. And if it does, we just say, can you take it down?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
sorry.
Just speaking on the internet there, and it kind of ties in with all of this. You are quite active on Twitter and things like that. And I really enjoyed, I felt you were a very reasoned voice when I was watching the insane unraveling of Andrew Lawrence, and when he'd had his rant that was coming across as sexist and racist and hard to tell, because I'd seen his stand up a few times and still think he's a great writer, a very, very talented dude, but there was instantly this backlash from the left, obviously, just attacking, and him then getting over defensive and being more offensive. And again, I didn't agree with what he said, but I thought, I remember seeing a tweet from you kind of just saying, look, we've all have points in our career where we feel that we're being ignored for what we're doing, and we deserve this or we deserve that, and someone else is in our place, but you're going about this the wrong way, and you're finding villains in, oh, it has to be a token woman, and women aren't funny on talk and all this kind of thing, and numerous other things. And yeah, I thought that was, again, it was great to see that medium used in quite a reasoned and calm
way. It was a
weird
thing. I mean, but I don't like any point where people start telling, certainly anyone creative, what they can and can't do.
Yeah.
And certainly once petitions get into it, and, you know, I think people should be, and I'm really into freedom of speech, and I think people should be allowed to say whatever they want. If they're wrong, you can go, look, you're wrong about this, let me tell you why. And then have a discussion about it. You know? Yeah, so I think people should be allowed to say anything.
I'm a big believer that the wave of e-petitions has killed any value of e-petitions. The fact that there was huge petitions to get Glastonbury to change their headliner shows a complete misunderstanding of a business. And you can't. Glastonbury's it's its own entity. You can't tell them who they have to book and not book. It's not the BBC. Devalues in many ways the power of what was a powerful thing of e-petitions, of being able to petition the BBC or the government or whoever else. When you can petition Andrew Lawrence to shut up, he doesn't have to obey that. Or when it's petitioned, if we get 1,000 names, Ian Duncan Smith should live on £1 a week for a year. It's not how life works. It doesn't.
But I think with Andrew Lawrence, I also recognised, not exactly myself in it, because I'd never say the things he said, but I think that the feeling behind it, I really understood. Because you know, you're working hard and you're creating something you're proud of, and it feels like, oh, why is it, you know, but you have to look at the bigger picture, and there's thousands of people trying to create stuff, and inevitably some of them aren't going to have their stuff acknowledged in the way if there is any way it should be should be acknowledged, but it's either luck or bad luck or good luck, or it's that inability to look and think this might be my fault, which a lot of people can't do. I think a lot of creative people can't do, because a lot of creative people aren't able to completely. Question themselves in that way, and weirdly a lot of Twitter trolls aren't allowed, if you try to make them question why they're doing it, it fucking makes their minds explode. If you say, doesn't this say more about you than it does about me? And they go, no, it doesn't. You're rubbish. Doesn't. I'm not going to think about myself. So, you know, it's easy to blame other people in the way your life's going, but you have to take control of it and do your best and work as hard as you can. And, the thing with Andrew, I completely understand it. Because I've complained about my career at times. And I have I'm at a similar level to him. He's got his own. It's ridiculous. He's saying, "Oh, you can't get on." He says with his own radio shows and his tours. You know, he boasts about how many people come and see him on tour. And there's always someone you can go, "Oh, I'm not doing as well as them." And because I worked with the first people I worked with are Steve Coogan, Chris Morris, I'm Andy Iannucci, Stuart Lee, Patrick Marber, all these people who've gone to be massively more conventionally successful.
Right.
Than I have. And so when people go, "Oh, you're not doing as well as Stuart, or you're not doing as well as Steve Coogan," you kind of go, "Yeah, I'm not, I'm not." But you have to, it's not about
who
comparing.
Is doing as well as Coogan.
Exactly. No, but Coogan will still be looking at whoever and going, Sacha Baron Cohen maybe, or someone else, he'll want something different. And actually, a lot of the people, you realise they haven't got, they're kind of pigeonholed in a different way. So Coogan, back in the day, he wouldn't want his Alan Partridge to be what he was known for. You know, he'd like to be taken seriously as a great actor. You know, which he is as well.
Yeah,
but in the end, I think he's embraced the Partridge aspect of himself and accepted it. So everybody is looking over their shoulders or are looking upwards and going, "Why aren't I that?" So you've got
such a weird balancing act as well, though, because I'll have that of. I'll know there's a certain fan base who think I'm hugely famous.
Yeah.
And again, you'll have that awareness that you're not. But then there will also be someone who goes, so do you do a music and that? And you kind of want to go, well, yeah, I'm quite successful. You know, it's that balance but of I'm not as successful as you think, but I'm definitely, there is success here. You should be acknowledging
this. I love it when that happens. You know, I'm going for 25 years and people go, I'll go and come in and go, oh, is it possible to make a living at that? And you do, sorry. Okay, you're going to go, no, yeah, I'm doing all right. Okay, fine. Because, you know, and I think the people who don't like me would be astonished to know how well, you know, I think they think I'm... Because I'm not on TV, they think I'm in some little gutter somewhere. And, But I'm very lucky. I make a lovely living doing what I want. There's jeopardy in it. I don't know whether I'll make money next year. You know, I lost lots of money last year but by taking some punts. But, you know, I'm doing fine, which is partly why I can carry on doing the free stuff. And living a lovely life. So it makes me laugh and I enjoy it, you know, and I like the fact. But I'm sure that still also happens to nearly everyone.
Yeah,
you know, completely. Even Paul McCartney, someone will go, so what do you do for a living?
Exactly.
Someone won't know.
We briefly mentioned Coogan there, and I want to get on to, I've never really known, I know you were, you and Stuart were, involved in the creation essentially of Partridge.
Yeah.
How did all that come about, and what was the going way back?
The real sort of truth is we'd come to London to do stand up and write, and we were working on a show called Weekending initially, which was the show that anyone could write on back then. It's not an anymore sort of topical show. And Armando Iannucci produced that for a while, and really, lots of people didn't like our stuff. I didn't really enjoy writing for that show. It was a very formulaic show, and we tried to write interesting stuff and often got rejected. But Armando really liked our stuff. We had known Armando vaguely from university, so we'd met him before, which obviously is not a hindrance. And then he was a producer, obviously, and he was doing this course, basically, where he came up with the idea of a parody news show. And so he asked us to come and work on it. And so it's very difficult to really, as it became apparent, in fact, and part of the reason it fell apart for us, it was very hard to work out who had created what, or who was responsible for what. Because there was writers who would come up with scenarios and lines and bits and pieces, and then it would go to the actors who would improvise around that.
Yeah.
I think the truth of it is that they were doing lots of different desks, like there was Green Desk and Sports Desk. And so we wrote quite a lot of material for those.
Yeah.
One of whom was a sports reporter. So we wrote sort of these weird...
Yeah.
Steve seems to remember it slightly differently to me. The bit I've read from his autobiography about it, and he's saying, you know, we wrote these quirky lines for him. And I feel that Marmando said Steve's come up with this good kind of quirky... that's the way I remember it.
Right.
But certainly we have no massive claim beyond writing probably the first things he said. Yeah. We didn't create the character.
Yeah.
It became a sort of joke because Patrick Marber, who we picked on a lot because for various reasons, and I feel a bit guilty about it now because I saw him the other day and he's really upset about it. But I thought he would get that it was a joke at our own expense as much as anything. As well as having a little bit of, I suppose, needle in there, really. Yeah. But where was I going with this? I forgot what I was going to say.
You just got on the subject of bullying Patrick poor Patrick.
I think he said in an interview, I expect Lee and Herring are claiming they've invented Alan Partridge.
Yeah.
Which we'd never done at that point. Yeah. So from then on, Stu always, when he was interviewed, claimed that he'd invented Alan Partridge. So I think it sort of came out of that. I don't think either of us really felt we'd invented Alan Partridge. But it was amazing to be, you know, that's our first proper job, really.
Yeah.
So it's a very high point to start at.
Yeah.
But I think, again, sort of luckily, I mean, when I met them, I was at Steve Coogan's birthday party, which is where... I saw him when he did my podcast, but I haven't seen much of him over the last few years.
Yeah.
But so I saw all of them again, and you kind of think there was a point where it went to day to day, and then we had a sort of bust up with them, and our manager was saying we couldn't work on it unless they gave us percentage of the characters we created, which is, I think he was right about.
Yeah.
But Stu had another job and was doing quite well with stand up, and I wasn't making much money, and that we were getting a 13-minute TV commission, and I pretty much knew this show was going to be. I was thinking, this is the new Monty Python. This is our generation's Monty Python, and we're not going to be involved in it. And the other day, I was thinking, I wonder, you know, if I'd made that. If at that point, I'd just said, I'm going to go and work on this, and if that means I have to leave my manager, and if that means I don't work with you anymore, Stu, that's what I'm going to do. That's what. And it's like Sliding Doors, my least favorite film. Yeah. But how different would my life have been? I mean, it would have been very, very different.
Yeah.
But not necessarily. I might still be working with them all. and be writing Veep, or I might not be.
but
you know, it's sort of it's an interesting thing to wonder. But then I'm glad I didn't miss out on the on doing the double act and having our own TV show. Which again, I think if I'd done that, I'd be a writer rather than a performer, probably.
So I do want to get to Fist of Fun and Richard the Nutter Judy, but what was your kind of comedic upbringing then? You grew up in Somerset, right?
And I was born in Yorkshire.
What were you into and what were you inspired by? And then what drew you to becoming, to trying out comedy?
Well, I just loved comedy right from the beginning. So I love people who could make me laugh. I love jokes, even if I didn't really understand them. My granddad was was always making me laugh, and I love her. So anyone who could make me laugh, I love. But I also knew I loved making people laugh.
I was reading your piece in the Metro today about the sad realisation that you've been great at making your daughter laugh, and then she was finding absolute hilarity in a brick wall the other day. So it's good that you're at this age still crediting your granddad for that. It was specifically his comedic performances that were making you laugh. So that's
exactly
good.
I like comedy. You know, I think I wanted to be a clown. You know, I sort of loved clowns, was scared of clowns when I was tiny. So it was just there straight. I remember doing a puppet show for my mum and nan behind the sofa with some finger puppets, and I remember them really laughing.
Yeah.
And obviously, in hindsight, they were laughing at how cute I was being.
I thought they
were laughing at my jokes, but they were laughing at how sweet this was.
Yeah.
But I remember them. I'm still remembering. You know, I can remember my mum really laughing and loving that feeling. So I knew I wasn't interested really in music in the way that other people were. I didn't mind it, but I didn't really like the way that it kind of tribalized everyone, and I felt like a lot of people were being phony about what they liked, you know.
And I
remember feeling as a teenager, you know, I don't like Phil Collins, but it seems wrong to me that if someone else likes Phil Collins, I'm not allowed to be their friend.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
That sort of seems weird.
Yeah.
And
Stuart can't really enjoy all that awful weird jazz, can he? It's just too much. That can't be real. That's got to be a line. So
I don't know. Who knows? Who knows? I mean, he spent a lot of money on it, so he must. Some part of him must think he likes it. But then I got comedy records. I've got Monty Python records, I think, first of all, and Pete and Dud when I was much too young. But it'd been a long time. I mean, in the old days on TV, a sort of young person's TV show would come along every 5 years or something. So Monty Python had come and gone. So I only got Monty Python through records. It wasn't being repeated.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't get videos. There were no video players at that point.
Yeah.
And so the only way you could get stuff was on tape or on vinyl.
Yeah.
So I'd listen to lots of records. And then 9 o'clock news came along, and that felt like our show.
It's interesting realising at that point, because not that stand-up wasn't as big, but there wasn't as easy access to it, that a lot of the stuff that you're listing there is ensemble or double acts.
Yeah.
You know, there's not really, this comedian. It's all, I liked these people together and their chemistry and all
well,
this.
Well, in the 70s, stand-up was much more working class, working men's club, racist.
Yeah. Yeah.
The comedians, which I did also enjoy, I have to say. So I liked jokes, but I even as a kid, I felt like jokes didn't have enough to them. And by the time I was a teenager, I just thought jokes were facile.
Yeah.
And so when someone like Monty Python came along and was exploring ideas and characters, Pete and Dud and being terrifically rude, 9 o'clock news, and then the young ones was a massive thing for me, Rick Mayall, Kevin Turvey, actually, to begin with.
Yeah.
Just because that was really felt like our generation, and it really felt like our thing, and adults didn't understand it, and we did understand it, you know. But I had a very good, rigorous sense of humour, and the stuff I liked, you know, I knew what I liked and I knew what was good, and I could tell the difference between things. I mean, I still like things like Cannon and Ball, but I knew I wasn't meant to.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was...
It's weird with things like that, because it's... Even now, when you look back, you have to kind of go, oh, that wasn't funny. at the time, there's so much that was,
Cannon and Ball...
Times were different.
First series of Cannon and Ball, I can remember seeing Bobby Ball the first time, and I was young. But the first time I saw what they were doing, it was really anarchic. And actually, Rick Mayall did Cannonball. There's a YouTube thing of him on Cannonball, which is weird. So I think they became a bit more mainstream. But I think they were mainstream, but there was just something amazing about them. Maybe just the age it was then. But it was getting into all those, you know, and that's part of the reason I wanted to go to Oxford, because I knew like a lot of those people I admired had come through that route. And that was, you know, that was the route. And I wasn't really into stand-up. And even in the 80s, I lived in Cheddar. There was no real way of seeing
it. It wasn't on the touring circuit.
So even to go, you know, I might have been able to go to Bristol and maybe see some of the comics guys if I'd been able to get my act together, but I couldn't drive, and yeah. you know, it was still a long way away.
Yeah.
So it was TV and records was the way I got everything, and yeah, and I was just, you know, I was a real comedy nerd, and things like Goon Show scripts and stuff like that. I was, you know, I'd ingest any of this stuff that I could. But so, you know, I went to university, and we did comedy at school. Weirdly, I was at school with a guy called Steve Cheek, who then went to Cambridge and met Simon Munnery, and they did a double act called God and Jesus at King Cambridge. So I seemed to kind of attach myself to these guys who were a bit sarcastic and, you know, seemingly at least intellectually ferociously clever and, you know, and are a bit, bit mean.
Yeah.
And Steve was a bit like that, and I'm a bit over, and I'm and certainly then was a little bit oversensitive, and but it kind of works as a dynamic. But yeah, so yeah, he worked with Simon Munnery, and who Simon Munnery obviously then did League Against Tedium and
Club Zarathustra,
and worked with Stu and stuff. You know, yeah. So it all kind of links up in a bizarre way. But Steve Cheek at school was a very driving force of, you know, understanding what was good comedy and wanting to do our own stuff. And I'm not sure without him whether I would have done that on my own. So we did quite a lot of comedy at school.
It's amazing how many all end up looping around and tying in and interlinking.
Yeah, I mean, I think out of anyone who isn't a comedian, Steve Cheek probably has more influence on the comedy scene in this country.
Really?
Having influenced me and Simon, and then Simon and me have influenced other people. You know, there's so many people, you know, and Stuart's come through that, and Stuart's influenced so many people. So there's a little seed, you know, when me and Stu met up, a lot of the things I was saying, you know, were things that at school Steve and I had decided we wouldn't do sketches about, such, you know, the things that were naff to do sketches about.
Yeah.
So, which I'm sure has then gone on to both of us and what we're doing. Yeah. So, yeah, so I wanted to go, you know, I'd done stuff at school and I kind of wanted to go to university just to do comedy, really.
That's amazing. Career choice in that manner. I'm going to uni purely for the comedy.
I mean, no, I hoped. It felt like a ridiculous dream. So, you know, there's a book called From Fringe to Flying Circus that I'd bought by, I think, kind of Roger Wilmot. And it just detailed all the Beyond the Fringe people and then Monty Python and everyone in between took their whole careers and how they'd started. And I was obsessed with this book. And obviously they'd all done student review.
Yeah.
By the time we did student review, it was massively uncool and we were bullied by all the prop stand-ups. It was awful. You know, I couldn't believe, I went to the university not really, thinking I'd get kicked out of university if you'd not been clever enough.
Yeah.
Turns out most people at Oxford were stupid.
Brilliant.
And I had exams at the end of my first term, which is so cruel. And I was sure I was going to fail those and get sent home. So I worked really hard for the first term and didn't do anything. But I met Stu there was a comedy club just started up in Oxford called the Fortnight. I think it was called the Fortnight Club or the Cellar. Oxford. It was in the cellar at the Oxford Union.
Yeah.
And I couldn't do any of them because I was working so hard. But then I did one of them. That was the 1 week Stu didn't turn up. So we met at the kind of Christmas party for this thing. But yeah, so once I'd just about passed these exams I had to do, I sort of more or less for the rest of the time just concentrated on comedy. And I really didn't think I would get far. And then, you know, me and Stu kind of got to go. We nearly got in the Oxford straight away and we formed this little sketch troupe, and it did, you know, it sort of really took off really quickly within university terms, and suddenly going, oh, this could happen. So then once I was there, I'm one of the kind of leading lights of the university scene.
Yeah.
You know, it sort of felt like a possible thing, and we went to Edinburgh a couple of times and, you know, and then thought, well, let's give it a go.
It gives you that confidence continue to pursue it.
That was a sort of starting point. But there probably isn't enough time to discuss. because I was so into sketch comedy and that was so unfashionable, and Oxford and Cambridge had basically lost their complete ascendance. Certainly Oxford in Edinburgh by that time, so it was taken over by stand-ups.
Yeah,
we got really genuinely bullied and. Keith Allen turned up to one of our shows and moved all the crash mats around and punched the theatre manager and stormed out after one sketch and then just reviewed us and said we were shit on TV. And then we had to go and do a write to reply and then they bullied
us. Thanks for coming.
They bullied us some more. And you know, there's a clip of me kind of going, well, you turn up at the show and you were drunk or on drugs and you went, you know, and he's going, woo, you know. So it was utterly humiliating. We got booked for Late in Live and all the stand-up comedians turned up just to heckle us, which is what Late in Live sort of was.
Yeah.
But we didn't really know that. So it felt like this real
just
animosity from the people I wanted to, in the industry I wanted to work in, it kind of really destroyed my confidence. I was overconfident before it. And also made me sort of passionately want to get behind sketches rather than stand up in the early days.
And do you feel that was based largely on the sketch element and the Oxford element, or had you started to get a level of success there and there was a backlash to that?
It was based on you know, the history of the, you know, I think the true history of the past in 10 years before, you know, anyone coming out of Oxbridge would go to the BBC and get their a radio series or whatever.
Yeah, straight,
but it wasn't really true. I mean, it certainly wasn't really true, ever true of Oxford, but it wasn't true at all anymore. And, you know, in fact, when we did get our radio stuff, our producer had to threaten to resign to get us on because weirdly the kind of Oxbridge people didn't get what we were doing and didn't like
right,
what we were doing.
Yeah.
So it was
so
more.
It must have been harsh to feel kind of like an outcast among an outcast because of where you've both come from.
So, you know, and it was, it felt like we were being, you know, we were all comprehensive. Stu did go to public schools on a scholarship, but all the people in the show were actually comprehensive kids.
Yeah.
So we were being judged as something we weren't. It was an interesting thing to experience, but it was a hard thing to cope with as a 19-year-old. And it was essentially adults bullying children for something they hadn't done, you know. So and I can understand it, and I really don't, I'm not exactly blaming them, but to understand that kind of prejudice, you know, it's an interesting to experience prejudice from a different direction and feel what it feels like was odd. But it did, it just put me on, you know, it really, when we came to London, Stu was really into doing stand-up, had done stand-up and had an act. And I really tried, but I didn't really like, you know, I felt this weird hurdle to overcome. And so when we started doing radio stuff on radio and that started working, obviously I kind of preferred to do that anyway. So I sort of stuck rigorously to sort of sketches being, and didn't enjoy doing stand-up. So coming back to stand-up later was quite a big deal for me.
So how was it when you had the TV shows and that kind of, that feeling, was there a feeling of, right, I've made it and it's going to be all plain sailing from here? Or was it a feeling of, shit, what are we doing, kind of, you know,
it says a lot about, I mean, comedy's changed a lot, and I think in those days, I mean, it was still, our progress was amazingly rapid.
Yeah.
I wish it hadn't been as rapid in hindsight, because it just felt like, we were sort of lucky, but, a lot of this business is about the luck of being at the right place at the right time, and being at the right place to do on the hour was a lot of luck.
I mean, you've pretty much had everything that people dream from in a career, but in a scattergun random order.
Yeah.
It's not like you went up and then have just dropped. It's like there's been up, then there's been this bit here, and then there's been this, and it's all on top of the world here. And then, you know,
it's difficult, but I don't feel personally I've really had I've not had a triumphant, you know, I haven't gone, yeah, there's not been a day, I've gone, I'm there. So even though, but when I look back at it, I go, look, that's pretty amazing. We had four BBC Two TV series. Basically, within 5 years, I'd achieved my ambition, which was to have, you know, our own TV sketch show. And then we did four series of that. But I think because it never, you know, it was so precarious, even when we had it, the first series we did it, and I thought it was the first series of Vistafon, I think, was really good. We worked really hard, especially me, I have to say. I wrote very hard. Stu was a bit lazy with the writing, but, we both still worked very hard. But my whole life was dedicated to comedy and nothing else, really. And I had no money. I was staying at home eating baked potatoes and just writing all day, and into the night and editing stuff in the night. And we wrote, 50 hours of radio, I think, before, in those 3 or 4 years we worked on the radio. And so getting a TV show, it felt like it was progressing as I had understood the progression should go. I didn't realise how rapid it was, and I don't think I appreciate how lucky we were. But also it didn't feel like it was a big success, because it didn't, we got reasonable ratings for Fist of Fun, but it didn't get amazing reviews, and we weren't being fated in the, it didn't feel like this is the...
Yeah.
It felt like still very much a cultish show, and then the BBC made us change it for the second series, which I think mildly ruined it. So there's still some... The sketch is sort of better in the second series, but the actual format's much worse. And then they took us off, and then it felt like it was over, and then we had a year where we were working out what was going to happen. And then Paul Jackson came in, who liked us and got us back on, and we're doing This Morning. And then we had 2 years of that, and then that got taken off. So, it never felt like we'd got over the hump.
Yeah.
And we weren't a success, and it wasn't like, we were still touring and no one was coming to see us.
Yeah.
So
it's crazy, those things, because I had Adam Buxton on the other week, and it's one of them weird ones, as you were kind of saying earlier, that people probably remember it being bigger than at least you felt it was at the time, because when you're in that kind of thing, you're very much aware of the numbers of comparison to other shows rather than just of what's actually happened. Do you know what I mean? So you're hyper aware of that, so in people's memory. So how kind of frustrating is it that you've to have something in your body at work that it's like, well, it's no good it being huge 10 years. You
know, well, no, it's no good being
I'm glad you remember it being massive, but.
Well, that's the, you know, so it's a weird thing because people, but then that was the weird reaction at the time because people who recognised you would go nuts, but they'd usually be the group of five people who didn't know you. And then they would go, oh, God, it's you. Look, it's him. And then they'd go, who is he? And then there's nothing, the person who'd recognise you would be angry with you.
There's nothing
not
more awkward than someone excitedly having to explain your career to friends who have no idea and trying to explain why they should be excited to meet you. And you have to be the kind of guy, you don't have to be excited to meet. It's like, I don't know.
But it was, you know, it was amazing, really. And we toured around, and you know, but it, I never enjoyed it, partly because Stu made it difficult to enjoy. He was always quite miserable and always quite, you know, down on stuff. And however things went, he would always bring it down or on it. And, we were touring around, but he was kind of this puritanical figure. Bring it down if we ever wanted to have any fun. So although we had lots of, you know, touring, being in a tour van with Stuart Lee and Kevin Eldon or Richard Thomas was lots of fun. But then also, you know, we were working so hard in each other's pockets and you know, annoying each other. And
I mean, it's a tough scenario to be
for 10 years. So it's really difficult. And all the time just thinking, trying to make it better. We did work really, really hard on it. Our producer really pushed us, I think, too far.
Yeah.
I think we made us rewrite when we didn't need to, you know. I think me and Stu would argue over like whether a sentence should have a or the in it, you know, for the first 4 hours.
Yeah.
Rather than just one of us going, oh, you this time you say you can have your one.
There's in any working relationship like that, there's a massive moment when you realise which battles to fight.
Exactly.
And again, that can be the killer thing, that you're arguing over the stupidest stuff that if by the time it's actually on TV, you probably won't remember which side you were arguing. You know you're arguing one, but you won't remember which one. So
exactly.
Yeah.
So you know it was just crazy, and I don't think, you know, I think I had a lot of hang-ups. I think a lot of this stuff from from this initial Edinburgh thing still hung over me. So I was quite insecure about everything. So I didn't enjoy it, you know. And then it had gone, and then it's passed. And I look back at it, and it doesn't feel like me in it.
Right.
I mean, I think that, you know, I'd watch it and I enjoy quite a lot of it. When we did the Fist of Fun commentaries, you know, mainly enjoyed it. Some of it you feel a bit embarrassed about, but I don't care about that. I think things, you're going to change your mind about what you think's funny over your career, and things are going to change.
Because Go Faster Stripe did the Fist of Fun DVD as well, didn't they? They had all the commentaries on there. Yeah, again, fantastic.
So, you know, so yeah, and that's, and it's lovely that did well and people wanted to buy that, and it was, you know, that it was, you know, it's sort of fun, but I think again it's sort of weird going back and dredging it up, and in a way in the end we had problems over this morning, and then I just realised it's better just to let it go, you know.
Yeah.
In fact, I had a quite good time just getting rid of it. I had loads of props and stuff and I eBayed them all just to get rid of it.
Yeah.
And I think it's just better to leave it behind.
Yeah, completely. So I mean, you look back at that and kind of it doesn't feel like it was you, which is kind of, again, I completely understand that, particularly when you are part of not only a double act, but there was a load of you touring together and all this.
Yeah.
So you're kind of, you're all a Fist of Fun, or you're all, you're all, or Lee and Herring or whatever. So when you did then step into your own shoes and return to stand up and do it on your own, do you look back at those and see it as the first time it was you coming through again? And how was that after the horribleness of those Edinburgh experiences? How much more pressure and nerve wracking was that to go, right, I'm on my own as well now?
It was really,
I'm stepping
really
out
difficult.
Here.
I mean, I find it much more difficult. I think like within the double act, Stu was more or less doing what he did in his stand up anyway.
Yeah.
Was very close to that, and I was playing a stupid character that was like me but wasn't me.
I mean, that was it, and the way you guys wrote a lot of that was you were a lot of the time reacting to Stu's anger or Stu's rant or whatever else, which then means he can go off and have that anger and rant in a similar style on his stand-up, but you can't be going, right, has everyone seen Stu's show? Because I'm now going to react for an hour to, you know, to that, can't work.
So. No, but, you know, I mean, it was, and even if you watch, I think if you watch both of us, but I think a lot of people say with Stu, you know, he does a little version of me in a lot of his routines now.
Right,
when he needs that, but he can do that with with that stuff.
Yeah, but yeah, of course. I never thought of that, but that's a great point. He does kind of, yeah.
But, and I think I'd probably do it with him, as we both have that duality, and we both used to write each other's stuff, you know, so it wasn't, it wasn't, in fact, in the double act, we often found it easier to be the other one than ourselves. But it was a massive deal for me, and I sort of had an interim period where I wrote Al Murray's sitcom. So I had this, so the TV show had finished, and so even though I kind of was disappointed about it, I was sort of more or less straight into having to work really hard on this sitcom. I wrote 37 episodes of a sitcom for Al Murray and with Al Murray, and but you know, A, that had the effect of like delaying my realization that things had changed, but B, also earned a lot of money, which I'd never done before.
Hell, that's so, a lot of fun.
So, you know, that gave me an actual security, you know, a borderline security. And I bought a house, you know, I put down a mortgage with a mortgage. And so that gave me this security that's been very useful.
Particularly in this kind of industry.
Yeah,
like anytime you can actually lock down something like that and be right now, you know, there's not that, you know, you've got that slight breathing space to be creative, to be artistic, to not just have to take the gigs that come along because you need to pay the bills.
And you can't, I don't think anyone, I couldn't do it now, you know, even if I got the same job, I don't think I couldn't afford to buy my house. Even if I was doing that, I got paid very, very well for that job, but even, you know, I wouldn't get paid as well for that job, but also we'd nowhere near having enough to put down on the house now. So it was, you know, I'm insanely lucky with that. But then it meant once that was over and then that wasn't going on, then I had to think about what I was going to do. And I moved into this house and I'd meant to be moving in with someone and that broke up. So I was living in this quite, you know, reasonable sized family house on my own. And and then trying to come to terms with the changes and what I was going to do and whether it was all over and then trying to work out how I was going to, but you know, I'd done Christ and Bike and Talking Cock, I suppose, around the same time. Which didn't feel like stand-up shows. They felt like theatre shows to me. I remember Christ on a Bike, it was a massive deal for me being on my own. I kept on trying to do things where I'd include the sound guy or something just to have someone to bounce off. And then managed to get rid of all those bits mainly in the end.
Yeah.
And but then creating that show and it working and being on stage on my own. But I remember being in Edinburgh the first time I was doing that show. I had a lapel mic anyway, but I had a mic on a stand that wasn't on.
Yeah.
But I just held on, and I just held on to it
just for that
all the way through, just to
have that security
But it gave me, it was a big confidence boost to be able to do that on my own. But I still didn't think of it as stand up.
Yeah.
Even though it was, but I couldn't have done that stuff in a stand up club, I suppose, just because it wouldn't have worked. But so that was one thing to get over and do that and realize I could perform on my own, because I'd just convinced myself I was better in ensemble or double act. You know, that was what I would do. I did.
And that's it's the confusing thing there is most things you're going to have worked on. Again, you're going to be working on both sides of it. As you were saying, you're both going to have been writing your jokes and Stu's jokes and back and forth, yet that then feeling. So it's kind of a misguided pressure of, can I do it on my own?
Yeah.
It's like, well, you definitely can, because you've been writing that. But then, I can understand that
and so
fear
was,
and paranoia.
That was a big deal. And both those shows, Christ on the Bike and Talking Cock, sort of did well in Edinburgh terms, you know, and I toured them to, you know, general indifference and did them in London when hardly anyone came. I think maybe Talking Cock did better. Talking Cock felt like it was going to take off, like massively. And it was at the same time as Stu was doing Jerry Springer the Opera, which felt like it was going to take off and didn't take off. And Talking Cock did very well, and I did a book and it got sold all around the world. So again, that was another that was the first show I'd done. Someone was doing it in France, and I was being sent a check for £3,000 every month.
Amazing.
And that felt quite good. And, you know, that was the only one that did really successfully. But, you know, people were paying me to put on the shows and elsewhere. And, you know, it felt like it was going to go bigger and become a TV show maybe.
Yep.
And then that didn't happen. So that was sort of weird. And then I had a year off in between, which maybe I was doing Time Jump and Please Again. I can't quite remember. Well, no, I think I just toured Talking Cock for 2 years. And then I did a show called The 12 Tasks of Hercules Terrace, which didn't do as well and was sort of too many ideas for an Edinburgh show, really. It was like I did 12 crazy things and then I taught them in an hour. It worked better over a tour show, but was still a bit of a weird mismatch of a show. But I did loads of, you know, it was a thing about trying to recreate The 12 Tasks of Hercules.
Yeah.
I was quite shy and I was quite, you know, I was quite, I didn't like taking risks and stuff. So I did this show which forced me to do parachute jumping, and I dated 50 women in 50 nights and did, I mean, nearly everything I did in it was a show in itself, really.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a crazy show. But having done that show, which sort of didn't work in Edinburgh, and I was in the wrong venue and the venue wasn't doing well and everyone didn't get paid and it was sort of weird. But doing that show, I kind of thought, well, why aren't I doing, sort of is stand-up. Yeah. Why have I got this problem with stand-up? Can't, you know, if I've done all these challenges.
Of putting it into some kind of other slight category when it's,
So then I thought, well, I've done all these things, I've pushed myself, and it's been, it was very good for me because it got me, I think I was a bit sort of useless and I was too shy and I was, I'd stay at home. I think throughout my 20s I was, I was on TV, but I was pretty much every weekend staying at home, playing Civilization 2 on my computer for, all weekend because I was too scared to ring up anyone and say, do you want to come out?
And there are achievements there, but they're not real world achievements. There's no.
So when you think about it, when people go, oh, it must have been amazing we've gone to, but seriously, we hardly went to any parties and there was lots of good things in it, as I have to say, but I was very shy and I was very self-conscious.
How was it on this recent revisiting of some of the earlier shows? Do you feel that you now had the ability to make it what it could be, like the example you were giving there, that you felt was too much to get across and fit in? Did you feel now you're experienced enough to go, right,
By the time I got to the end of that tour, the show was working. It didn't work in Edinburgh, but going back to it, that was one of the shows I was most impressed with, because I think my opinion of it was the lowest, but actually because it's a show about being depressed and it's a show about nearly going mad. And then breaking up with someone and then getting out of it. And it's a really positive ending. And I did this, the middle of it was me doing this number plate game where you have to see numbers from 1 to 999 in consecutive numerical order.
Yes.
It's like a really impossible game that I tried to play as a kid and couldn't do. And then I took it on as this thing, and then it became this central thing, and it always became a religion, and I somehow managed to do it.
Yeah.
But then I had this kind of, and I was worried that, when I finished it, I was worried it was going to send me mad, because I sort of start believing in these, as a joke, believing in these gods. And then I was worried that once I'd finished it, would the gods appear or they wouldn't appear, life would fall apart, or I'd suddenly have nothing to live for. And the end of the show is me saying, but then nothing happened, and I was thinking that's a bit weird. But then, having finished it, I walked back to my house and I was looking at, I was seeing the trees and the happy faces of the little kids. And for the first time in 2 years, I was looking at things that weren't car number plates and having I've had this very moving. I'm slightly moved by now. And to go back on it, I found it especially moving. But to the realization that by doing that crazy thing, I sort of had realized something, that I needed to do that. But by getting out of the way, and I do this, and I messed up on the night actually, but it was this idea of sometimes, you don't, and there's a noise then you don't know it's there, but when it's gone, suddenly it's silent. And you know, it's that kind of thing that actually having got through it,
it was a very positive, through that
and then realizing all the things that it made me do that were crazy, but they had kind of, and I'd got a girlfriend at the end of it, and all these things that happened. And it was a very positive show. So it's a lovely, I actually think it's a really lovely show that, again, was like a little bit overlooked.
The simplicity there of having to put yourself through tasks that aren't enjoyable to then have the enjoyment of not doing them tasks anymore is a very deep and philosophical thing.
I was really terrified. It was just a tandem parachute. I was terrified of doing that, but I remembered after finishing that as well, it was just like, I felt so alive just for having done it, and I remember feeling,
did you
like
feel
amazing.
Alive from having done it or from having to not have to do it
both of those things,
kind of like I never have to do that again,
but it's
now.
Over
that's
because
happened.
The anticipation was so awful and it was a kind of amazing thing to do, but absolutely not want to do it again.
Amazing.
So all the but I think all these things, they're learning experiences. So even if that show hadn't been good, and I think it was good in the end, and I think looking back at it, as I say, there's a really lovely story to the show, even if it was just sort of realizing that I must do stand up. And that, so going back to doing stand up, so I've been writing a blog for a few years by then, never thinking these blogs could be stand up material, but then realizing subsequently that some of it could be stand up material. But then it's unusual stand up material because it's all about the little things I'm noticing in the world that are kind of crazy again. So that created a really weird show called Someone Likes Yogurt, which again I got partly bashed and partly loved, but I think is my most popular stand-up show probably in terms of sales and stuff, and I really like it. It's nuts and it's just persistent and awful, and I'm like the dog with a bone in it, but there's some really great stuff in it. But so that got me back into that, so that I think sort of realizing I could do stand-up, that, and that was enough for me as a performer. And I think I've been sitting at home writing books and writing scripts, and I realized that even just going getting back into stand-up, realising, even just going to a little pub, I remember passing the Hammersmith Apollo and Jimmy Carr was on, and I was then doing a pub round the corner and there were 10 people in the audience.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, you know, there's part of me thinking, oh, that's, you know, when you think about where I was and where I am. But I was so happy just to be performing to those 10 yeah. people and knowing it's harder to perform to 10 people than,
than
3,000 people.
Yeah, yeah.
And it scratched the itch of performance enough that I realised I don't need, it doesn't matter to me the level I'm at.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's nicer if more people are coming and I'm making yep. some money, but and more people like you. But I've got that. So that makes me a lot happier that I can do that performing. It doesn't have to be on TV. It doesn't have to be a big deal. And then I can get on with the rest of my life.
Yeah,
so.
The continual act of creating.
Yeah.
Of creating something that you can be pleased of, that works.
Yeah.
That's reassuring yourself in many ways that you're good at this. This yeah. is something that you're capable of this.
And I became, you know, and I wasn't good at it too. And I wasn't great at it being with stand-up. And I was very nervous when the first gigs. I was sort of doing bits of talking cock and bits and pieces and... You know, I think a couple of someone's yoghurt. I think, you know, the people kept on doing parallels between me and Stu, obviously, at the time.
Yeah.
But I think, because we were doing similar things because we'd worked together. But yeah. I think the hand job routine in someone like Yoghurt and Menage and the next one, that's the only one I think that is like a Stuart Lee routine that I've copied off Stuart Lee. The rest of it is very much, you know, my take on what we both like doing, which was taking an idea and shaking it to death and then carrying on shaking it to death. But then combined with getting good at stand-up, realizing that was something I could do and that was been stupid about it, that I could tour those shows, which would give me something to do and a bit of a revenue, and also then the internet coming in, you know, at that point. So 2008, so I'd had 3 or 4 years of being a stand-up and then got into the kind of internet stuff and then realizing potentially, you know, that I still write scripts for TV and do obviously bits of appearances on TV every now and again, panel shows and stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, I did realize that there was a way of maybe keeping control of everything and that it's actually more to do with, you know, to me, it's more important the stuff gets out there and is created than is it's even that many people see it or that you make money out of or that you become famous from it. I'd rather create good stuff that I think's good.
Yeah.
If other people do as well, that's great. If other people go, that was a bit ropey. So the snooker thing is one of my favourite things I do. It makes a lot of people confused and angry and think I'm mad. But that's partly what it's about. It's about experimenting with madness again. And it's about experimenting with the competition within yourself, which I think is the most important competition.
Yeah.
And you can never defeat yourself and you can never escape yourself. And it's about the duality of humanity. And it's a stupid idea. You know, it's all framed in a stupid, annoying thing that the part of the joke is I'm doing it and part of the joke is you're listening to it.
Completely. So I did a thing 1 year. I'd had a relationship, a breakup around Christmas.
Right.
It was either Christmas Eve or Christmas Day. And the Watchmen film was on.
Right.
And I loved the book. And I'm one of the few that enjoyed the film.
Right.
And I decided to do a live stream of me watching the Watchmen just as a who watches the Watchmen thing.
Yeah.
And you couldn't see the TV. You could just see me watching the Watchmen.
Yeah.
I'd comment every now and then. And then someone else started to do a stream of them watching me watching the Watchmen. And that was just a spur of the moment thing. But I was just so happy in them. I was like, and it's like, this is just great that we're all getting, it's Christmas.
But
it's obviously the people who are a bit lonely because we're all happen to be online at this time of year. But yeah.
But that's what, like, you know, there's a lot of bad about the internet and there's lots of negative things about social media. But I think I love the way it does bring people together in that way. I love the way you can do a joke that lasts for 6 years. I mean, the snooker thing's a joke that's lasted for sort of 6 years.
Yeah.
That started as a Twitter thing, you know, or any of those things. Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm going to start to wrap things up and let you get on your way. But we talked earlier about the feeling that it's hard to really break down too much of a career because so much of it you've just been making up as you go along.
Yeah.
That's kind of the nature of it. Do you feel now going forward that you've worked yourself to a point where you can have that bit more of a plan going forward? It feels like you've got the setup of the podcast is yours. The podcast is something that you're in control of and it's not dependent on if you get commissioned or anything else. It's your own thing. And similar with the Edinburgh shows, again, you've built that career and that reputation that you know that you can keep producing good shows and keep having an audience there. Does it feel like you've got more of a plan going forward now, or is there more that...
I think, you know, to be honest, last year, and part of the reason I didn't go back to Edinburgh again was because I had this kind of weird experience in Edinburgh, but realised that it wasn't necessarily the right place for me to be trying stuff out anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of wondered whether it was, you know, I still wonder whether it's going to all fall apart.
Yeah.
So I did this play that people didn't come and see, and I lost a heap of money on it.
Right.
And even my stand-up show, I was banking on making a bit of money to offset what I was imagining were smaller costs. And that didn't make any money, you know, because it was on later. And so not as many people came as I was hoping.
Right. So, yeah.
So I, you know, and I was doing a show I thought was really pleased with, and the play was what I was pleased as well, but I thought it was really good, but people weren't that interested. You know, so I still feel like a little bit like there's a tenuous risk there.
You know,
that next year people might go, oh no, we've had enough anymore. I'm bored of the Leicester Square Theatre podcast. Or I might get bored of it, or we might not, you know, it might just feel too repetitive. At the moment, it feels like it's evolving.
Yeah.
But I've pulled out of, you know, something like As It Occurs to Me, which is my other, I think probably my most successful podcast in a way, in terms of getting people to come and see me at least.
Yeah.
I kind of got, you know, I found it too difficult and it was upset, you know, it was driving me mad and I thought I'd stop doing it. And I think if I'd been more sensitive, I mean, we might start reviving it, but it'll be a different thing again. But I maybe should have carried on doing that.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah.
So, you know, so I'm likely to get bored of something or change my mind. Or, you know, just know, but I like that about it. You know, I like the risk and the danger. You know, I'm thinking of moving now, and the choice is, do I move to a smaller house and not have a mortgage, or do I move to a bigger house
and have a big mortgage to
fight against? And so, you know, and there's a part of me thinking both ways, because if I know I don't have to work, I'm not sure I would work.
Just having that constant motivation. Hanging over you.
Yeah. So, you know, I think I'm... And you never know what's going to happen health-wise and all that sort of stuff. So as you get older, and I don't, you know, I've got a young family now and I want to enjoy my daughter. So there's things but that drives you both ways. It drives you to think, well, I don't want to work, but then it always thinks, well, I'd want to make sure, but it makes me want to work in the right, make sure I'm focusing correctly. I think, you know, I'm excited about what the possibilities are. I don't know whether I'll make it in that certain sense, but, you know, I don't know whether the plans to expand that the internet stuff will work, I mean, I suppose the nice thing is having got through that last year in Edinburgh and then come out and the tour went fine and paid for all my expenses and was good, and then I've created, you know, I'm over halfway to creating a new show that I think is going to be better, and so that's good. But, you know, every year you think, oh, what if I don't think of anything to do?
Yeah.
What if it all dries up? So
it's that weird thing that doubt will all, it feels like it will forever remain there.
Yeah.
No matter how many years you've had of consistently producing new material, consistently. And again, I have that, like, every album I finish, I'm kind of thinking, pretty sure that's all I've got. I'm pretty sure that's everything there. And then the next album comes about and it works.
Once you've finished something, it's pretty good, especially with touring.
Yeah.
You know, it's getting better all the time. By the end of the tour, you might sort of observe it as you're doing it and go, wow, how did I come up with this? This is really clever. And then you think, I've got to write the next one. How did I do that in the last one?
You've forgotten how you got there.
Because it's come about by a process of hours and hours of working or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, that's a terrifying moment when you leave one show and have to go to the next one. But, you know, I think I'm really content with who I am and where I am. And I think for a long time, I wasn't.
Yeah.
I was either wanting to be more recognised or more famous or more successful or, you know, or just, or whatever, you know. I'm really glad none of that's, you know, I think there was a point, I think, like, with the Lee and Herring stuff, there would have been a point where I would have loved being famous and marrying a supermodel and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm so glad I didn't go down that road. And I'm so glad I don't have that. And I think it would have driven me mad. And I think if Lee and Herring had been Little Britain, let's say, I don't know why that came out of my head, then, you know, I think it would have destroyed us both. I think Stu wouldn't have liked being that popular, and I would have gone nuts the other way.
For Civilization keeping you in and keeping you on.
Well, I'm
on
very
track.
Unlikely to meet a supermodel with the lifestyle I have. But it's, you know, it's. But I think, you know, I've been. I can't believe I've been depressed in my life because I've had a very lucky life and as you say, I've worked for 25 years and always worked, and I can't imagine that there isn't something for me to do for the next 20 years. Yeah. So, you know, even if it isn't before me, even if it's just producing or script editing or whatever.
It's an interesting industry, and I was discussing this with, I had Kurt Sutter on last week, who wrote Sons of Anarchy and The Shield and stuff like that. And it's a fascinating industry because every time in entertainment, you kind of, you'll see the movies and think, I love movies.
Yeah.
I want to be a movie star. And you'll forget that there's a million other roles that are part of that as well.
Yeah.
And that's a similar thing, I think. As soon as you've been at the front, you forget that in all this experience, you've got the experience to produce.
Yeah.
So if there is a point where you feel, I am done with being on stage. I'm done with this. Yeah. Like, you've had so many years of experience of the booking side of it, the tour managing side, everything else that you can. There's loads coming. Yeah, so but it's that constantly scary thing because it's not a job where you've got your pension and you know everything else all stacked up there.
No, but you know, I think what's nice is I do sort of feel content and I don't feel bitter about anything.
Yeah.
Most of the time. And I don't, I'm not looking at other people going, oh, I wish that was me. You know, I genuinely look at Stu and I'm delighted for him because I think he deserves it and people expect me to be, you know, and I think it also just gives you hope that can happen.
Completely.
So, you know, so there's lots of positives. I mean, it could have happened to a nicer person, but there's lots of positives from it. But, you know, but also...
It literally could have happened to a nicer person.
But there's lots of, you know, and also whether you want that, you know, I think that's it. I think it's that sort of... I'd quote it in my program. It's not quite in the show, but there's in Vanity Fair, which I studied for A-level.
Yeah.
Dobbin, this character, spends his whole life trying to court this woman... And eventually he marries her, and then it's just not that good. And you know, there's a line saying he realised the prize he'd spent his life trying to get wasn't worth the winning, which I vaguely quoted earlier. And I just sort of think that's, you know, I sort of think the thing that I would have aspired to and wanted from this, I would have hated and would have destroyed me.
That's it.
And what I've got is much more valuable and much more enjoyable.
Completely. I had Billy Bragg on the podcast a while back, and one of the things that he said was the thing that's most painful for him to see is people who get their dream and realise they're not happy and realise that they're miserable, who have this dream of being a rock and roll star, and then they get to do it, and then they're like, all right.
Yeah.
And he's like, he said he felt lucky that he got it and he loves it, and it's, you know, what he got is he's at that level and that place that's just, it's exactly what he
needed it to be. Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, he loves music. I love comedy. You know, I always loved comedy, and I'm being a comedian. So, if, you know, if I asked my 14-year-old self and I did it in Headmaster's Son but if he knew what I was doing, I mean, I think, I don't know, he might say, you know, what's the internet and that's not as good as being on TV, and he might be right about that. But, you know, I'm actually a comedian.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm working in the thing I love, and I love comedy, and you know, and if I can help other people be better and do better, I'm delighted about that. So that's the nice thing, you know. And I think if you're constantly striving for something that's actually unattainable or that you think will complete you, you know, you think this is the thing that's going to make me happy.
That's the saddest thing. That's the scariest thing to have, right?
I see those people, you know, and they're kind of friends with Elton John, and they're young people, and you kind of go, why? Why aren't you friends with people from school?
Yeah, yeah.
And why is that better? Being friends with Elton John, is that better than being friends with your
mates.
People you're at university with? Well, so, you know.
Yeah. I think that's perfect. I think that's completely made sure that we're going to have absolutely nothing to talk about on Sunday on your podcast. I'm glad I got in first. I'm glad I got in first and used all of our conversation. But thank you very much, sir.
No, thank you for having me. It's a lot of fun.
Thanks for coming down. I look forward to joining you.
I feel like I've been on a psychiatrist's account.
Perfect.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was Richard Herring for the 70th episode of the Distraction Pieces podcast. And that was a lovely chat. It felt like we could have gone on forever. And that was pleasing because, as I mentioned at the start, later that week, we were going on more on Richard Herring's podcast. And I'm now recording this outro after that's happened, and I was very pleased that we had loads to talk about, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I think I mentioned earlier, to Richard, that I felt when I was on his podcast in Edinburgh, I wasn't very good. Thankfully, you'll be pleased to know I fucking killed it this time. So that was good, and that's coming out in January, I think, on Richard Herring's podcast, so that'll be great. It's December now, right? And I figured December, it's Christmas and that, innit? And it's cold, so people are either wanting to have a reason to not go out
or their journeys to work are just all that more horrible and painful. So I thought, for the first week of December, let's give you two Distraction Pieces podcasts. Because, you know, it's December and we'll give you a little treat. And last month, in November, I forgot to mention this. I believe that was our biggest month ever. So thank you all for spreading the word and all the new listeners and downloaders. So, I mean, the two live ones went down a treat. But then after that, Adam Buxton, Chris Jericho, Kurt Sutter, and now Richard Herrin. Richard Herrin, I guess, is in December. That's what I'm saying, December. But yeah, just shut up. It's been a good month. Thank you. So I'm rewarding you with an extra guest this week. So we're going to have a Friday podcast this week. And our guest, so that'll be episode 71, is a guy called John Osborne, who's fantastic. A lot of you know of him. I've had him on my stage at Camp Bestival and Bestival numerous times. He's a spoken word artist and writer in general. But he's just had a new series out on Sky One, which is amazing. It's a comedy that he's written, and it's the first kind of script he's written, I believe. And it's this amazing a comedy called After Hours, which is about essentially a pirate radio station. And it's fantastic. And yeah, we decided to have a quick chat, and I thought that'd go well as a two to kick off December, to give you an extra little treat. So you will hear that next week. I highly recommend it. It's fascinating, because I didn't get around to mention it, and I'll probably end up mentioning this in my intro or outro. It's amazing how much John has achieved, and that sounds derogatory. It's not. He's an amazingly talented writer, but he's never struck me as the most kind of, business-minded. Never struck me as one to be out networking or a go-go. He works with a lot of different poets, and there's a particular poet who a lot of you, again, will know, called Luke Wright, who's very much, you know, he's great at his PR, his networking, getting in with the arts councils and things like that. And John, as amazingly talented as he is, has never struck me as that guy or having that side of his game yet. He's now had three books. He's now got a TV series. And yeah, amazingly successful. So it's a great story. And he explains all that. He explains how it all came about and what he's done and how he kind of has, in a way, he lived his life and weirdly crafted his social life to prepare him for when these opportunities have come up. It's weird. Again, I don't think it was particularly intentional, but it happened that everything he seemed to be doing in his life meant that when these opportunities did come, they were just, you know, perfect for him. But yeah, so check that out on Friday, a little extra one, spread the word. Thank you for tuning in. It'd be lovely if you could subscribe and give like 5-star reviews on iTunes and stuff like that, and just tell your friends. I mean, I go on about this a lot, but just tell your friends. I think podcasts are the future. There's been some great ones. We're looking at doing, actually, I'll reveal it as an exclusive now. I'm looking at doing a few episodes at the end of the year that are going to be a year in review. And it's going to be going over films, some music, news, and some of my favourite podcasts, not of my own, or maybe some of my own as well, of the year. And I'm planning on doing it with a couple of my mates, and I'll reveal all that down the line. And the plan is to just go through each month. The other plan is to get drunk, so I don't know how many episodes it will spread over, but you're guaranteed that by the end of it we'll be an absolute mess. But yeah, that's the plan for the kind of Christmas and New Year specials, would be me and a couple of my mates just talking about the year. Again, starting in January, I'll have a list of kind of events, and I'll have some events, and then we'll see what drums up conversation and excitement, and then we'll work through the year. So yeah, that's something to look forward to, right? We've got more this week, so this week on Friday is John Osborne, and next week is a fascinating one, and I'm very, very excited about it. It feels like an important one too. I sat down and spoke with Dale Vince, who is the founder of a company called Ecotricity, and they're the first green energy company in the UK. And that sounds like hippie bullshit. So some of you will be put off, but don't. because I, as you'll know with all my conversations, I don't go in there. I'm not a journalist, so I don't go in there to attack or put anyone down, but I also don't go in there to kiss anyone's ass, if you know what I mean. A lot of people, I mean, the first ever episode was with a Russell Brand, and at the time, I felt that was one of the first interviews with him that wasn't either just chastising him or just praising him. We kind of had discussions. There were things that we didn't agree on. There were things that we did agree on. So I went into this one with a similar mindset, ready for there to be a few bits I'm not really down with or don't agree with or don't believe in. But man, it was a fascinating chat. It really opened my eyes to a lot of the changes in technology in recent years, a lot of the huge developments, and a lot of the options. So yeah, that'll be next Wednesday. So check that out. I'm thinking the Wednesday after that. I'm just telling you all my plans now. I'm going to try and get Itch from King Blues on. Everyone keeps requesting it. A lot of people know I've known Itch for years. He's a great poet, a great front man. He's a great activist. And I keep meaning to get him on. It's weird sometimes with the people that I know so well. They're the ones that end up not coming on immediately because all the other ones, it's like it happens to be if someone's in town for that day or in town for a few days or whatever else. So, yeah, it's kind of an odd one there. But, yeah, we're hoping to get that in because they've announced just recently that the King Blues are getting back together, which is fantastic news. So, yeah, I'm going to try and sit down with Itch. I'll try and get that in before Christmas. I'll try and get that in before we do the year-end review ones because it feels new and relevant and we'll get that in. But, yeah, that's the plans. This is a long outro, isn't it? A long episode in general now. I should go. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.